that it was just that she had not planned a large procession past Barry, that this was really a family affair. Dreadfully apologetic, Tessa said that she quite understood, and was then left to explain to Colin, who retreated into a mortified, wounded silence. He had simply wanted to stand alone beside Barry's body and pay silent homage to a man who had occupied a unique place in his life. Colin had poured truths and secrets he had confided to no other friend into Barry's ears, and Barry's small brown eyes, robin bright, had never ceased to regard him with warmth and kindness. Barry had been Colin's closest ever friend, giving him an experience of male comradeship he had never known before moving to Pagford, and was sure he would never have again. That he, Colin, who felt himself to be perpetually the outsider and the oddball, for whom life was a matter of daily struggle, had managed to forge a friendship with the cheerful, popular and eternally optimistic Barry, had always seemed a small miracle. Colin clutched what was left of his dignity to him, resolved never to hold this against Mary, and spent the rest of the day meditating on how surprised and hurt Barry would have been, surely, at his widow's attitude. 3 miles outside Pagford, in an attractive cottage called Smithy, Gavin Hughes was trying to fight off an intensifying gloom. Mary had called earlier. In a voice that trembled with the weight of tears, she had explained how the children had all contributed ideas for tomorrow's funeral service. Siobhan had grown a sunflower from seed and was going to cut it and put it on top of the coffin. All 4 kids had written letters to be put inside the casket with their father. Mary had composed one too, and was going to put it in Barry's shirt pocket, over his heart. Gavin put down the receiver, sickened. He did not want to know about the children's letters, nor about the long-nurtured sunflower, yet his mind kept returning to these things as he ate lasagna alone at his kitchen table. Though he would have done anything to avoid reading it, he kept trying to imagine what Mary had written in her letter. A black suit was hanging in dry cleaner's polythene in his bedroom like an unwelcome guest. His appreciation of the honour Mary had done him in publicly acknowledging him as one of those closest to the popular Barry had long since been overwhelmed by dread. By the time he was washing up his plate and cutlery at the sink, Gavin would have gladly missed the funeral altogether. As for the idea of viewing his dead friend's body, it had not and would never have occurred to him. He and Kay had had a nasty row the previous evening and had not spoken since. It had all been triggered by Kay asking Gavin if he would like her to go with him to the funeral. "Christ, no," Gavin had said before he could stop himself. He had seen her expression and knew instantly that she had heard, "Christ, no, people will think we're a couple. Christ, no, why would I want you?" And although these were precisely his feelings, he had attempted to bluff his way through. "I mean, you didn't know him, did you? It'd be a bit weird, wouldn't it?" But Kay had let rip, tried to corner him, to make him tell her what he really felt, what he wanted, what future he envisioned for the two of them. He had fought back with every weapon in his arsenal, being alternatively obtuse, evasive, and pedantic, for it was wonderful how you could obscure an emotional issue by appearing to seek precision. At last, she had told him to get out of her house. He had obeyed, but he knew that it was not over. That would be way too much to hope for. Gavin's reflection in the kitchen window was drawn and miserable. Barry's stolen future seemed to hang over his own life like a looming cliff. He felt inadequate and guilty, but he still wished that Kay would move back to London. Night drew in over Pagford, and in the old vicarage, Parminda Jawanda perused her wardrobe, wondering what to wear to say goodbye to Barry. She had several dark dresses and suits, any one of which would be appropriate, and yet still she looked backwards and forwards along the rail of clothes, mired in indecision. "Wear a sari. It'll upset Shirley Morrison. Go on, wear a sari." It was so stupid to think that. Mad and wrong. And even worse to think it in Barry's voice. Barry was dead. She had endured nearly 5 days of deep grief for him, and tomorrow they would bury him in the earth. The prospect was unpleasant to Parminda. She had always hated the idea of internment, of a body lying whole under the ground, slowly rotting away, riddled with maggots and flies. The Sikh way was to cremate and to scatter the ashes in running water. She let her eyes wander up and down the hanging garments, but her saris, worn to family weddings and get-togethers back in Birmingham, seemed to call to her. What was this strange urge to don one? It felt uncharacteristically exhibitionist. She reached out to touch the folds of her favourite, dark blue and gold. She had last worn it to the Fairbrothers New Year's party when Barry had attempted to teach her to jive. It had been a most unsuccessful experiment, mainly because he did not know what he was doing himself. But she could remember laughing as she almost never laughed, uncontrollably, madly, the way she had seen drunk women laugh. The sari was elegant and feminine, forgiving of middle-aged spread. Parminda's mother, who was 82, wore it daily. Parminda herself had no need of its camouflaging properties. She was as slim as she had been at 20. Yet she pulled out the long, dark length of soft material and held it up against her dressing gown, letting it fall to caress her bare feet, looking down its length at its subtle embroidery. To wear it would feel like a private joke between herself and Barry, like the cow-faced house and all the funny things Barry had said about Howard as they walked away from interminable, ill-humoured council meetings. There was a terrible weight on Parminda's chest, but did not the Guru Granth Sahib extort friends and relatives of the dead not to show grief, but to celebrate their loved one's reunion with God? In an effort to keep traitorous tears at bay, Parminda silently intoned the night-time prayer, the Kirtan Sohila. My friend, I urge you that this is the opportune time to serve the saints. Earn divine profit in this world and live in peace and comfort in the next. Life is shortening day and night. O mind, meet the Guru and set right your affairs. Lying on her bed in her dark room, Sukhvinda could hear what every member of her family was doing. There was the distant murmur of the television directly below her, punctuated by the muffled laughter of her brother and her father, who were watching a Friday night comedy show. She could make out her elder sister's voice across the landing, talking on her mobile to one of her many friends. Nearest of all was her mother, clunking and scraping in the built-in wardrobe on the other side of the wall. Sukhvinda had drawn the curtains over her window and placed a draft excluder, shaped like a long sausage dog, along the bottom of her door. In the absence of a lock, the dog impeded the door's progress. It gave her warning. She was sure that nobody would come in, though. She was where she ought to be, doing what she ought to be doing, or so they thought. She had just performed one of her dreadful daily rituals, the opening of her Facebook page and the removal of another post from a sender she did not know. As often as she blocked the person bombarding her with these messages, they changed their profile and sent more. She never knew when one would appear. Today's had been a black and white image, a copy of a 19th century circus poster. La véritable femme à barbe, Miss Anne Jones Elliot. It showed the photograph of a woman in a lacy dress, with long dark hair and a luxuriant beard and moustache. She was convinced that it was Fats Wall who was sending them, although it might have been somebody else. Dane Tully and his friends, for instance, who made soft, grunting, ape-like noises whenever she spoke in English. They would have done it to anybody of her colour. There were hardly any brown faces at Winterdown. It made her feel humiliated and stupid, especially as Mr. Gary never told them off. He affected not to hear them, or else to hear only background chatter. Perhaps he too thought that Sukhvinda Kaur Jawanda was an ape, a hairy ape. Sukhvinda lay on her back on top of her covers and wished with all of her being that she was dead. If she could have achieved suicide simply by willing it, she would have done it without hesitation. Death had come to Mr. Fairbrother. Why could it not happen to her? Better yet, why could they not swap places? Neve and Siobhan could have their father back, and she, Sukhvinder, could simply slip into non-being, wiped out, wiped clean. Her self-disgust was like a nettle suit. Every part of her prickled and burnt with it. She had to will herself moment by moment to endure, to remain stationary, not to rush to do the one and only thing that helped. The whole family had to be in bed before she acted. But it was agony to lie like this, listening to her own breathing, conscious of the useless weight of her own ugly and disgusting body on the bed. She liked to think of drowning, of sinking down into cool green water, and feeling herself slowly pressed into nothingness. The great hermaphrodite sits quiet and still. Shame ran down her body like a burning rash as she lay in the darkness. She had never heard the word before Fats Wall spoke it in maths on Wednesday. She would not have been able to look it up. She was dyslexic. But he had been kind enough to explain what it meant, so there was no need. The hairy man-woman. He was worse than Dane Tully, whose taunts had no variety. Fats Wall's evil tongue fashioned a fresh, tailor-made torture every time he saw her, and she could not shut her ears. His every insult and jibe was branded on Sukhvinder's memory, sticking there as no useful fact had ever done. If she could have been examined on the things he had called her, she would have achieved the first A grade of her life. Tash and tits, hermaphrodite, the bearded dumbbell. Hairy, heavy and stupid, plain and clumsy. Lazy, according to her mother, whose criticism and exasperation rained down upon her daily. A bit slow, according to her father, who said it with an affection that did not mitigate his lack of interest. He could afford to be nice about her bad grades. He had Jaswant and Rajpal, both top of every class they took. Poor old Jolly, Vikram would say carelessly, after glancing through her report. But her father's indifference was preferable to her mother's anger. Parminder did not seem able to comprehend or accept that she had produced a child who was not gifted. If any of the subject teachers made the slightest hint that Sukhvinder might try harder, Parminder seized upon it in triumph.
Sukhvinder is easily discouraged and needs to have more faith in her abilities. There, you see, your teacher is saying you don't try hard enough, Sukhvinder.
Of the only class in which Sukhvinder had reached the second set, computing, Fats Wall was not there, so she sometimes dared put up her hands to answer questions, Parminder said dismissively,
"The amount of time you children spend on the internet, I'm surprised you're not in set one."
Never would it have occurred to Sukhvinder to tell either of her parents about the ape grunts or about Stuart Wall's endless stream of malice. It would mean confessing that people beyond the family also saw her as substandard and worthless. In any case, Parminder was friends with Stuart Wall's mother. Sukhvinder sometimes wondered why Stuart Wall did not worry about their mother's connection, but concluded that he knew that she would not give him away. He saw through her. He saw her cowardice, as he knew her every worst thought about herself, and was able to articulate it for the amusement of Andrew Price. She had fancied Andrew Price once, before she realized that she was utterly unfit to fancy anyone, before she realized she was laughable and strange. Sukhvinder heard her father's voice and Rajpal's growing louder as they came up the stairs. Rajpal's laughter reached a crescendo right outside her door.
"It's late," she heard her mother call from her bedroom. "Vikram, he should be in bed."
Vikram's voice came through Sukhvinder's door, close by, loud and warm. "Are you asleep already, Jolly?" It was her childhood nickname, bestowed in irony. Jaswant had been Jazzy, and Sukhvinder, a grizzling, unhappy baby, rarely smiling, had become Jolly.
"No," Sukhvinder called back. "I've only just gone to bed."
"Well, it might interest you to know that your brother here..."
But what Rajpal had done was lost in his shouting protests, his laughter. She heard Vikram moving away, still teasing Rajpal. Sukhvinder waited for the house to fall silent. She clung to the prospect of her only consolation, as she would have hugged a lifebelt, waiting, waiting for them all to go to bed. And as she waited, she remembered that evening not long ago, at the end of rowing practice, when they had been walking through the darkness towards the car park by the canal. You were so tired after rowing. Your arms and your stomach muscles ached, but it was a good, clean pain. She always slept properly after rowing. And then Crystal, bringing up the rear of the group with Sukhvinder, had called her a silly, packy bitch. It had come out of nowhere. They'd all been messing around with Mr. Fairbrother. Crystal thought she was being funny. She used fucking interchangeably with very and seemed to see no difference between them. Now she said packy as she would have said dozy or dim. Sukhvinder was conscious of her face falling and experienced the familiar sliding, scalding sensation in her stomach.
What did you say?
Mr. Fairbrother had wheeled around to face Crystal. None of them had ever heard him properly angry before.
I didn't mean nothing, said Crystal, half taken aback, half defiant. I was only joking. She knows I was just joking, don't you?
She demanded of Sukhvinder, who muttered cravenly that she knew it was a joke.
I never want to hear you use that word again.
They all knew how much he liked Crystal. They all knew he'd paid for her to go on a couple of their trips out of his own pocket. Nobody laughed louder than Mr. Fairbrother at Crystal's jokes. She could be very funny. They walked on, and everybody was embarrassed. Sukhvinder was afraid to look at Crystal. She felt guilty, as she always did. They were approaching the people carrier when Crystal said, so quietly that even Mr. Fairbrother did not hear it, I was joking. And Sukhvinder said quickly, I know. Yeah, well... Sorry. It came out as a mangled monosyllable, and Sukhvinder thought it tactful not to acknowledge it. Nevertheless, it cleaned her out. It restored her dignity. On the way back to Pagford, she initiated, for the first time ever, the singing of the team's lucky song, asking Crystal to start with Jay-Z's rap. Slowly, very slowly, her family seemed to be putting themselves to bed at last. Jaswant spent a long time in the bathroom, clinking and crashing around. Sukhvinder waited until Jaz had finished primping herself, until her parents had stopped talking in their bedroom, for the house to fall silent. Then at last it was safe. She sat up and pulled the razor blade out from a hole in the ear of her old cuddly rabbit. She had stolen the blade from Vikram's store in the bathroom cabinet. She got off the bed and groped for the torch on her shelf and a handful of tissues, then moved into the furthest part of her room, into the little round turret in the corner. Here she knew the torch's light would be confined and would not show round the edges of the door. She sat down with her back against the wall, pushed up the sleeve of her nightshirt, and examined by torchlight the marks left by her last session, still visible, crisscrossed and dark on her arm, but healing. With a slight shiver of fear that was a blessed relief in its narrow, immediate focus, she placed the blade halfway up her forearm and sliced into her own flesh. Sharp, hot pain and the blood came at once. When she had cut herself right up to her elbow, she pressed the wad of tissues onto the long wound, making sure nothing leaked onto her nightshirt or the carpet. After a minute or two, she cut again, horizontally, across the first incision, making a ladder, pausing to press and to mop as she went. The blade drew the pain away from her screaming thoughts and transmuted it into animal burning of nerves and skin, relief and release in every cut. At last she wiped the blade clean and surveyed the mess she had made, the wounds intersecting, bleeding, hurting so much that tears were rolling down her face. She might sleep if the pain did not keep her awake, but she must wait for 10 or 20 minutes, until the fresh cuts had clotted over. She sat with her knees drawn up, closed her wet eyes, and leaned against the wall beneath the window. Some of her self-hatred had oozed out with the blood. Her mind drifted away to Gaia Borden, the new girl, who had taken such an unaccountable fancy to her. Gaia could have hung out with anyone with her looks and that London accent. Yet she kept seeking out Sukhvinder at lunchtimes and on the bus. Sukhvinder did not understand it. She almost wanted to ask Gaia what she thought she was playing at. Day by day, she expected the new girl to realize that she, Sukhvinder, was hairy and ape-like, slow and stupid, someone to be despised and grunted at and insulted. No doubt she would recognize her mistake soon, and Sukhvinder would be left, as usual, to the bored pity of her oldest friends, the Fairbrother twins. Saturday. 1. Every parking space in Church Row was taken by 9 o'clock in the morning. Darkly clothed mourners moved singly, in pairs and in groups, up and down the street, converging like a stream of iron filings drawn to a magnet on St. Michael and All Saints. The path leading to the church doors became crowded, then overflowed. Those who were displaced fanned out among the graves, seeking safe spots to stand between the headstones, fearful of trampling on the dead, yet unwilling to move too far from the church entrance. It was clear to everyone that there would be not enough pews for all the people who had come to say goodbye to Barry Fairbrother. His co-workers from the bank, who were grouped around the most extravagant of the Sweetlove tombs, wished that the august representative from head office would move on and take his inane small talk and his clumsy jokes with him. Lauren, Holly and Jennifer from the rowing team had separated from their parents to huddle together in the shade of a mossy-fingered yew. Parish councillors, a motley bunch, talked solemnly in the middle of the path, a clutch of balding heads and thick-lensed glasses, a smattering of black straw hats and cultured pearls. Men from the squash and golf clubs hailed each other in subdued fashion. Old friends from university recognized each other from afar and edged together, and in between milled what seemed to be most of Pagford, in their smartest and most somber-hued clothes. The air droned with quiet conversations, faces flickered, watching and waiting. Tessa Wall's best coat, which was of grey wool, was cut so tightly around the armholes that she could not raise her arms above chest height. Standing beside her son on one side of the church path, she was exchanging sad little smiles and waves with acquaintances while continuing to argue with Fats through lips she was trying not to move too obviously. "For God's sake, Stu, he was your father's best friend. Just this once, show some consideration." "No one told me it was going to go on this bloody long. You told me it'd be over by 11:30. "Don't swear. I said we'd leave St. Michael's at about 11:30. So I thought it'd be over, didn't I? So I arranged to meet off. But you've got to come to the burial. Your father's a pallbearer. Ring off and tell him it'll have to be tomorrow instead." "He can't do tomorrow. Anyway, I haven't got my mobile on me. Cubby told me not to bring it to church." "Don't call your father Cubby. You can ring off on mine," said Tessa, burrowing in her pocket. "I don't know his number by heart," lied Fats coldly. She and Colin had eaten dinner without Fats the previous evening, because he had cycled up to Andrew's place, where they were working on their English projects together. That, at any rate, was the story Fats had given his mother, and Tessa had pretended to believe it. It suited her too well to have Fats out of the way, incapable of upsetting Colin. At least he was wearing the new suit that Tessa had bought for him in Yarville. She had lost her temper at him in the third shop because he looked like a scarecrow in everything he had tried on, gawky and graceless, and she had thought angrily that he was doing it on purpose, that he could have inflated the suit with a sense of fitness if he chose. "Shh," said Tessa preemptively. Fats was not speaking, but Colin was approaching them, leading the Jawandas. He seemed, in his overwrought state, to be confusing the role of pallbearer with that of usher, hovering by the gates, welcoming people. Parminda looked grim and gaunt in her sari, with her children trailing behind her. Vikram in his dark suit looked like a film star. A few yards from the church doors, Samantha Mollison was waiting beside her husband, looking up at the bright, off-white sky and musing on all the wasted sunshine beating down on top of the high ceiling of cloud. She was refusing to be dislodged from the hard-surfaced path, no matter how many old ladies had to cool their ankles in the grass. Her patent leather high heels might sink into the soft earth and become dirty and clogged. When acquaintances hailed them, Miles and Samantha responded pleasantly, but they were not speaking to each other. They had had a row the previous evening. A few people had asked after Lexi and Libby, who usually came home at weekends, but both girls were staying over at friends' houses. Samantha knew that Miles regretted their absence. He loved playing paterfamilias in public. Perhaps, she thought, with a most pleasurable leap of fury, he would ask her and the girls to pose with him for a picture on his election leaflets. She would enjoy telling him what she thought of that idea. She could tell that he was surprised by the turnout. No doubt he was regretting that he did not have a starring role in the forthcoming service. It would have been an ideal opportunity to begin a surreptitious campaign for Barry's seat on the council with this big audience of captive voters. Samantha made a mental note to drop a sarcastic allusion to the missed opportunity when a suitable occasion arose. "Gavin," called Miles, at the sight of a familiar, fair and narrow head.
"Oh, hi, Miles. Hi, Sam."
Gavin's new black tie shone against his white shirt. There were violet bags under his light eyes. Samantha leaned in on tiptoes so that he could not decently avoid kissing her on the cheek and inhaling her musky perfume.
"Big turnout, isn't it?"
Gavin said, gazing around.
"Gavin's a pallbearer," Miles told his wife,
in precisely the way that he would have announced that a small and unpromising child had been awarded a book token for effort. In truth, he had been a little surprised when Gavin had told him he had been accorded this honour. Miles had vaguely imagined that he and Samantha would be privileged guests, surrounded by a certain aura of mystery and importance, having been at the deathbed. It might have been a nice gesture if Mary, or somebody close to Mary, had asked him, Miles, to read a lesson, or say a few words to acknowledge the important part he had played in Barry's final moments. Samantha was deliberately unsurprised that Gavin had been singled out.
"You and Barry were quite close, weren't you, Gav?"
Gavin nodded. He felt jittery and a little sick. He had had a very bad night's sleep, waking in the early hours from horrible dreams in which, first, he had dropped the coffin so that Barry's body spilt out onto the church floor, and secondly, he had overslept, missed the funeral, and arrived at St. Michael and All Saints to find Mary alone in the graveyard, white-faced and furious, screaming at him that he had ruined the whole thing.
"I'm not sure where I ought to be," he said, looking around. "I've never done this before."
"Nothing to it, mate," said Miles. "There's only one requirement, really. Don't drop anything."
Miles's girlish laugh contrasted oddly with his deep speaking voice. Neither Gavin nor Samantha smiled. Colin Wall loomed out of the mass of bodies. Big and awkward-looking, with his high, knobbly forehead, he always made Samantha think of Frankenstein's monster.
"Gavin," he said. "There you are. I think we should probably stand out on the pavement. They'll be here in a few minutes."
"Righto," said Gavin, relieved to be ordered around.
"Colin," said Miles, with a nod.
"Yes, hello,"
said Colin, flustered, before turning away and forcing his way back through the mass of mourners. Then came another small flurry of movement, and Samantha heard Howard's loud voice.
"Excuse me, so sorry, trying to join our family."
The crowd parted to avoid his belly, and Howard was revealed, immense in a velvet-faced overcoat. Shirley and Maureen bobbed in his wake. Shirley neat and composed in navy blue, Maureen scrawny as a carrion bird in a hat with a small black veil.
"Hello, hello," said Howard, kissing Samantha firmly on both cheeks. "And how's Sammy?"
Her answer was swallowed up in a widespread, awkward shuffling as everybody began retreating backwards off the path. There was a certain discreet jockeying for position. Nobody wanted to relinquish their claim to a place near the church entrance. With this cleaving in two of the crowd, familiar individuals were revealed like separate pips along the break. Samantha spotted the Joanders, coffee-brown faces among all the whey. Vikram, absurdly handsome in his dark suit. Parminder, dressed in a sari. Why did she do it? Didn't she know she was playing right into the likes of Howard and Shirley's hands? And beside her, dumpy little Tessa Wall in a grey coat, which was straining at the buttons. Mary Fairbrother and the children were walking slowly up the path to the church. Mary was terribly pale and appeared pounds thinner. Could she have lost so much weight in 6 days? She was holding one of the twins' hands, with her other arm around the shoulders of her younger son, and the eldest, Fergus, marching behind. She walked with her eyes fixed straight ahead, her soft mouth pursed tight. Other family members followed Mary and the children. The procession moved over the threshold and was swallowed up in the dingy interior of the church. Everyone else moved towards the doors at once, which resulted in an undignified jam. The Mollisons found themselves shunted together with the Joanders.
"After you, Mr. Joander, sir, after you," boomed Howard, holding out an arm to let the surgeon walk in first.
But Howard made sure to use his bulk to prevent anybody else taking precedence over him, and followed Vikram immediately through the entrance, leaving their families to follow on. A royal blue carpet ran the length of the aisle of St. Michael and All Saints. Golden stars glimmered on the vaulted ceiling. Brass plaques reflected the glow of the hanging lamps. The stained glass windows were elaborate and gorgeously hued. Halfway down the nave, on the epistle side, St. Michael himself stared down from the largest window, clad in silver armour. Sky-blue wings curved out of his shoulders. In one hand he held aloft a sword, in the other a pair of golden scales. A sandaled foot rested on the back of a writhing bat-winged Satan, who was dark grey in colour and attempting to raise himself. The saint's expression was serene. Howard stopped level with St. Michael and indicated that his party should file into the pew on the left. Vikram turned right into the opposite one, while the remaining Mollisons and Maureen filed past him into the pew. Howard remained planted on the royal blue carpet and addressed Parminder as she passed him.
"Dreadful, this. Very. Awful shock."
"Yes," she said, loathing him.
"I always think those frocks look comfy. Are they?" he added, nodding at her sari.
She did not answer, but took her place beside Jaswant. Howard sat down too, making of himself the prodigious plug at the end of the pew that would seal it off to newcomers. Shirley's eyes were fixed respectfully on her knees, and her hands were clasped, apparently in prayer, but she was really mulling over Howard and Parminder's little exchange about the sari. Shirley belonged to a section of Pagford that quietly lamented the fact that the old vicarage, which had been built long ago to house a high church vicar with mutton-chop whiskers and starched apron staff, was now home to a family of Hindus. Shirley had never quite grasped what religion the Joanders were. She thought that if she and Howard went to the temple or the mosque or wherever it was the Joanders worshipped, they would doubtless be required to cover their heads and remove their shoes and who knew what else, otherwise there would be outcry. Yet it was acceptable for Parminder to flaunt her sari in church. It was not as though Parminder did not have normal clothes, for she wore them to work every day. The double standard of it all was what rankled. Not a thought for the disrespect it showed to their religion, and, by extension, to Barry Fairbrother himself, of whom she was supposed to have been so fond. Shirley unclasped her hands, raised her head, and gave her attention over to the outfits of people who were passing, and of the size and number of Barry's floral tributes. Some of these had been heaped up against the communion rail. Shirley spotted the offering from the council for which she and Howard had organised the collection. It was a large, round, traditional wreath of white and blue flowers, which were the colours of Pagford's arms. Their flowers and all the other wreaths were overshadowed by the life-sized oar made of bronze chrysanthemums which the girls' rowing team had given. Sukhvinda turned in her pew to look for Lauren, whose florist mother had made the oar. She wanted to mind that she had seen it and liked it, but the crowd was dense, and she could not spot Lauren anywhere. Sukhvinda was mournfully proud that they had done it, especially when she saw that people were pointing it out to each other as they settled themselves in their seats. 5 of the 8 girls on the team had stumped up money for the oar. Lauren had told Sukhvinda how she had tracked down Crystal Whedon at lunchtime and exposed herself to the piss-taking of Crystal's friends, who were sitting smoking on a low wall by the newsagent. Lauren had asked Crystal if she wanted to chip in.
"Yeah, I will, all right," Crystal had said.
But she had not, so her name was not on the card. Nor, as far as Sukhvinda could see, had Crystal come to the funeral. Sukhvinda's insides were like lead, but the ache of her left forearm, coupled with the sharp twinges of pain when she moved it, was a counter-irritant, and at least Fats Wall, glowering in his black suit, was nowhere near her. He had not made eye contact with her when their two families had met, briefly, in the churchyard. He was restrained by the presence of their parents, as he was sometimes restrained by the presence of Andrew Price. Late the previous evening, her anonymous cyber-torturer had sent her a black-and-white picture of a naked Victorian child covered in soft, dark hair. She had seen it and deleted it while dressing for the funeral. When had she last been happy? She knew that, in a different life, long before anyone had grunted at her, she had sat in this church and been quite content for years. She had sung hymns with gusto at Christmas, Easter, and Harvest Festival. She had always liked St. Michael, with his pretty, feminine, pre-Raphaelite face, his curly golden hair. But this morning, for the first time, she saw him differently. With his foot resting almost casually on that writhing dark devil, she found his untroubled expression sinister and arrogant. The pews were packed. Muffled clunks, echoing footsteps and quiet rustlings animated the dusty air as the unlucky ones continued to file in at the back of the church and took up standing room along the left-hand wall. Some hopeful souls tiptoed down the aisle in case of an overlooked place in the crammed pews. Howard remained immovable and firm until Shirley tapped his shoulder and whispered, "Aubrey and Julia." At which Howard turned massively and waved the service sheet to attract the Fawleys' attention. They came briskly down the carpeted aisle, Aubrey tall, thin, and balding in his dark suit, Julia with her light red hair pulled back into a chignon. They smiled their thanks as Howard moved along, shunting the others up, making sure that the Fawleys had plenty of room. Samantha was jammed so tightly between Miles and Maureen that she could feel Maureen's sharp hip joint pressing into her flesh on one side and the keys in Miles's pocket on the other. Furious, she attempted to secure herself a centimetre or so more room, but neither Miles nor Maureen had anywhere else to go, so she stared straight ahead and turned her thoughts vengefully to Vikram, who had lost none of his appeal in the month or so since she had last seen him. He was so conspicuously, irrefutably good-looking, it was silly. It made you want to laugh. With his long legs and his broad shoulders and the flatness of his belly where his shirt tucked into his trousers and those dark eyes with the thick black lashes, he looked like a god compared to other Pagford men who were so slack and pallid and porky. As Miles leaned forward to exchange whispered pleasantries with Julia Fawley, his keys ground painfully into Samantha's upper thigh, and she imagined Vikram ripping open the navy wrap dress she was wearing, and in her fantasies she had omitted to put on the matching camisole that concealed her deep canyon of cleavage. The organ stops creaked and silence fell, except for a soft, persistent rustle. Heads turned. The coffin was coming up the aisle. Barry's brothers were both 5'6", and Colin Wall at the rear 6'2", so that the back end of the coffin was considerably higher than the front. The coffin itself was not made of polished mahogany, but of wickerwork.
"It's a bloody picnic basket," thought Howard, outraged.
Looks of surprise flitted across many faces as the willow box passed them, but some had known all about the coffin in advance. Mary had told Tessa, who had told Parminda, how the choice of material had been made by Fergus, Barry's eldest son, who wanted willow because it was a sustainable, quick-growing material and therefore environmentally friendly. Fergus was a passionate enthusiast for all things green and ecologically sound. Parminda liked the willow coffin better, much better than the stout wooden box in which most English disposed of their dead. Her grandmother had always had a superstitious fear of the soul being trapped inside something heavy and solid, deploring the way that British undertakers nailed down the lids. The pallbearers lowered the coffin onto the brocade-draped bier and retreated. Barry's son, brothers, and brother-in-law edged into the front pews, and Colin walked jerkily back to join his family. For 2 quaking seconds, Gavin hesitated. Parminda could tell that he was unsure of where to go, his only option to walk back down the aisle under the eyes of 300 people. But Mary must have made a sign to him because he ducked, blushing furiously into the front pew beside Barry's mother. Parminda had only ever spoken to Gavin when she had tested and treated him for chlamydia. He had never met her gaze again.
"I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die."
The vicar did not sound as if he were thinking about the sense of the words issuing from his mouth, but only about his own delivery, which was sing-song and rhythmic. Parminda was familiar with his style. She had attended carol services for years with all the other St. Thomas parents. Long acquaintance had not reconciled her to the white-faced warrior saint staring down at her, nor all the dark wood, the hard pews, the alien altar with its jewelled golden cross, nor the dirgy hymns, which she found chilly and unsettling. So she withdrew her attention from the self-conscious drone of the vicar and thought again of her father. She had seen him out of the kitchen window, flat on his face, while her radio continued to blare from on top of the rabbit hutch. He had been lying there for 2 hours while she, her mother and her sisters had been browsing in Topshop. She could still feel her father's shoulder beneath his hot shirt as she had shaken it.
"Daddy! Daddy!"
They had scattered Darshan's ashes in the sad little River Ray in Birmingham. Parminda could remember the dull clay look of its surface on an overcast day in June, and the stream of tiny white and grey flakes floating away from her. The organ clunked and wheezed into life, and she got to her feet with everybody else. She caught a glimpse of the backs of Neve and Siobhan's red-gold heads. They were exactly the age she had been when Darshan had been taken from them. Parminda experienced a rush of tenderness and an awful ache, and a confused desire to hold them and to tell them that she knew, she understood.
"Morning has broken like the first morning."
Gavin could hear a shrill treble from along the row. Barry's younger son's voice had not yet broken. He knew that Declan had chosen the hymn. That was another of the ghastly details of the service that Mary had chosen to share with him. He was finding the funeral an even worse ordeal than he had expected. He thought it might have been better with a wooden coffin. He had had an awful, visceral awareness of Barry's body inside that light wickerwork case. The physical weight of him was shocking. All those complacently staring people as he walked up the aisle, did they not understand what he was actually carrying? Then had come the ghastly moment when he'd realized that nobody had saved him a place, and that he would have to walk all the way back again while everybody stared and hide among the standees at the back. But instead, he'd been forced to sit in the first pew, horribly exposed. It was like being in the front seat of a roller coaster, bearing the brunt of every awful twist and lurch. Sitting there, mere feet from Siobhan's sunflower, its head as big as a saucepan lid, in the middle of a big burst of yellow freesias and daylilies, he actually wished that Kay had come with him. He could not believe it, but there it was. He would have been consoled by the presence of somebody who was on his side, somebody simply to keep him a seat. He'd not considered what a sad bastard he might look turning up alone. The hymn ended. Barry's older brother walked to the front to speak. Gavin did not know how he could bear to do it, with Barry's corpse lying right in front of him beneath the sunflower, grown from seed over months, nor how Mary could sit so quietly with her head bowed, apparently looking at the hands clasped in her lap. Gavin tried actively to provide his own interior interference, so as to dilute the impact of the eulogy. He's going to tell the story about Barry meeting Mary once he's got past this kid stuff. Happy childhood, hijinks, yeah, yeah. Come on, move it along. They would have to put Barry back in the car and drive all the way to Yarville to bury him in the cemetery there, because the tiny graveyard of St. Michael and All Saints had been declared full 20 years previously. Gavin imagined lowering the wickerwork coffin into the grave under the eyes of this crowd. Carrying it in and out of the church would be nothing compared to that. One of the twins was crying. Out of the corner of his eye, Gavin saw Mary reach out a hand to hold her daughter's.
Let's get on with it, for fuck's sake, please. I think it's fair to say that Barry always knew his own mind,
Barry's brother was saying, hoarsely. He'd got a few laughs with tales of Barry's scrapes in childhood. The strain in his voice was palpable.
He was 24 when he went off on my stag weekend to Liverpool. First night there, we leave the campsite and go off to the pub, and there behind the bar is the landlord's student daughter, a beautiful blonde, helping out on a Saturday night. Barry spent the whole night propping up the bar, chatting her up, getting her into trouble with her dad and pretending he didn't know who the rowdy lot in the corner were.
A weak laugh. Mary's head was drooping. Both hands were clutching those of the child on either side.
He told me that night, back in the tent, that he was going to marry her. I thought, hang on, I'm the one who's supposed to be drunk.
Another little titter.
Baz made us go back to the same pub the next night. When we got home, the first thing he did was buy her a postcard and send it to her, telling her he'd be back next weekend. They were married a year to the day after they met, and I think everyone who knew them would agree that Barry knew a good thing when he saw it. They went on to have 4 beautiful children, Fergus, Neve, Siobhan, and Declan.
Gavin breathed carefully in and out, trying not to listen, and wondering what on earth his own brother would find to say about him under the same circumstances. He had not had Barry's luck. His romantic life did not make a pretty story. He had never walked into a pub and found the perfect wife standing there, blonde, smiling, and ready to serve him a pint. No, he had had Lisa, who had never seemed to think him up to scratch. 7 years of escalating warfare had culminated in a dose of the clap, and then, with barely a break, there had been Kay, clinging to him like an aggressive and threatening barnacle. But all the same, he would ring her later, because he didn't think he'd be able to stand going back to his empty cottage after this. He would be honest, and tell her how horrible and stressful the funeral had been, and that he wished she'd come with him. That would surely deflect any lingering umbrage about their row. He did not want to be alone tonight. 2 pews back, Colin Wall was sobbing with small but audible gasps into a large, wet handkerchief. Tessa's hand rested on his thigh, exerting gentle pressure. She was thinking about Barry, about how she had relied upon him to help her with Colin, of the consolation of shared laughter, of Barry's boundless generosity of spirit. She could see him clearly, short and ruddy, jiving with Parminda at their last party, imitating Howard Mollison's strictures on the fields, advising Colin tactfully as only he could have done, to accept Fats's behaviour as adolescent rather than sociopathic. Tessa was scared of what the loss of Barry Fairbrother would mean to the man beside her, scared of how they would manage to accommodate this huge, ragged absence, scared that Colin had made a vow to the dead that he could not keep, and that he did not realise how little Mary, to whom he kept wanting to talk, liked him. And through all Tessa's anxiety and sorrow was threaded the usual worry, like an itchy little worm. Fats, and how she was going to avert an explosion. How she would make him come with them to the burial, or how she might hide from Colin that he had not come, which might, after all, be easier. We're going to finish today's service with a song chosen by Barry's daughters, Niamh and Siobhan, which meant a lot to them and their father, said the vicar. He managed, by his tone, to disassociate himself personally from what was about to happen. The beat of the drum rang so loudly through hidden speakers that the congregation jumped. A loud American voice was saying, uh-huh, uh-huh, and Jay-Z rapped. Good girl gone bad, take three, action, no clouds in my storms, let it rain, I hydroplane into fame, coming down with the Dow Jones. Some people thought it was a mistake. Howard and Shirley threw outraged glances at each other, but nobody pressed stop or ran up the aisle apologising. Then a powerful, sexy female voice started to sing. You have my heart. And we'll never be worlds apart. Maybe in magazines, but you'll still be my star. The pallbearers were carrying the wicker coffin back down the aisle, and Mary and the children were following. Now that it's raining more than ever, know that we'll still have each other. You can stand under my umbrella. You can stand under my umbrella. The congregation filed slowly out of the church, trying not to walk in time to the beat of the song. 2. Andrew Price took the handlebars of his father's racing bicycle and walked it carefully out of the garage, making sure that he did not scrape the car. Down the stone steps and through the metal gate, he carried it. Then, in the lane, he put his foot on one pedal, scooted a few yards and swung his other leg over the saddle. He soared left onto the vertiginously sloping hillside road and sped, without touching his brakes, down towards Pagford. The hedgerows and sky blurred. He imagined himself in a velodrome as the wind whipped his clean hair and his stinging face, which he had just scrubbed clean. Level with the Fairbrothers' wedge-shaped garden, he applied the brakes, because some months previously he had taken this sharp turn too fast and fallen off, and had had to return home immediately with his jeans ripped open and grazes all down one side of his face. He freewheeled, with only one hand on the bars, into Church Row, and enjoyed a second, though lesser, downhill burst of speed, slightly checked when he saw that they were loading a coffin onto a hearse outside the church, and that a dark-clothed crowd was spilling out between the heavy wooden doors. Andrew pedalled furiously around the corner and out of sight. He did not want to see Fats emerging from church with a distraught cubby, wearing the cheap suit and tie that he had described with comical disgust during yesterday's English lesson. It would have been like interrupting his friend having a crap. As Andrew cycled slowly around the square, he slicked his hair back off his face with one hand, wondering what the cold air had done to his purple-red acne and whether the antibacterial face wash had done anything to soothe the angry look of it. And he told himself the cover story. He'd come from Fats's house, which he might have done, there was no reason why not, which meant that Hope Street was as obvious a route down to the river as cutting through the first side street. Therefore, there was no need for Gaia Borden, if she happened to be looking out of the window of her house, and happened to see him and happened to recognise him, to think that he had come this way because of her. Andrew did not anticipate having to explain to her his reason for cycling up her street, but he still held the fake story in his mind because he believed it gave him an air of cool detachment. He simply wanted to know which was her house. Twice already at weekends, He had cycled along the short, terraced street, every nerve in his body tingling, but he had been unable, as yet, to discover which house harboured the Grail. All he knew, from his furtive glimpses through the dirty school bus windows, was that she lived on the right-hand, even-numbered side. As he turned the corner, he tried to compose his features, acting the part of a man cycling slowly towards the river by the most direct route, lost in his own serious thoughts, but ready to acknowledge a classmate should they show themselves. She was there, on the pavement. Andrew's legs continued to pump, though he could not feel the pedals, and he was suddenly aware how thin the tyres were on which he balanced. She was rummaging in her leather handbag, her copper-brown hair hanging around her face, number 10 on the door ajar behind her, and a black T-shirt falling short of her waist, a band of bare skin, and a heavy belt and tight jeans. When he was almost past her, she closed the door and turned. Her hair fell back from her beautiful face, and she said quite clearly in her London voice, "Oh, hi." "Hi," he said. His legs kept pedalling. 6 feet away, 12 feet away. Why hadn't he stopped? Shock kept him moving. He dared not look back. He was at the end of her street already. "For fuck's sake, don't fall off." He turned the corner, too stunned to gauge whether he was more relieved or disappointed that he had left her behind. Holy shit. He cycled on towards the wooded area at the base of Pargeter Hill, where the river glinted intermittently through the trees, but he could see nothing except Gaia burned onto his retina like neon. The narrow road turned into an earthy footpath, and the gentle breeze off the water caressed his face, which he did not think had turned red, because it had all happened so quickly. "Fucking hell," he said aloud to the fresh air and the deserted path. He raked excitedly through this magnificent, unexpected treasure trove. Her perfect body, revealed in tight denim and stretchy cotton, number 10 behind her on a chipped, shabby blue door. "Oh, hi," easily and naturally, so his features were definitely logged somewhere in the mind that lived behind the astonishing face. The bike jolted on the newly pebbly and rough ground. Elated, Andrew dismounted only when he began to overbalance. He wheeled the bicycle on through the trees, emerging onto the narrow riverbank, where he slung the bicycle down on the ground among the wooden anemones that had opened like tiny white stars since his last visit. His father had said, when he first started to borrow the bike, "You chain it up if you're going into a shop. I'm warning you, if that gets nicked." But the chain was not long enough to go around any of the trees, and, in any case, the further he rode from his father, the less Andrew feared him. Still thinking about the inches of flat, bare midriff and Gaia's exquisite face, Andrew strode to the place where the bank met the eroded side of the hill, which hung like an earthy, rocky cliff in a sheer face above the fast-flowing green water. The narrowest lip of slippery, crumbling bank ran along the bottom of the hillside. The only way of navigating it, if your feet had grown to be twice the length they had been when they had first made the trip, was to edge along sideways, pressed to the sheer face, holding tight to roots and bits of protruding rock. The mulchy green smell of the river and of wet soil was deeply familiar to Andrew, as was the sensation of this narrow ledge of earth and grass under his feet, and the cracks and rocks he sought with his hands on the hillside. He and Fats had found the secret place when they were 11 years old. They had known that what they were doing was forbidden and dangerous. They had been warned about the river. Terrified, but determined not to tell each other so, they had sidled along this tricky ledge, grabbing at anything that protruded from the rocky wall and, at the very narrowest point, clutching fistfuls of each other's T-shirts. Years of practice enabled Andrew, though his mind was barely on the job, to move crab-wise along the solid wall of earth and rock with the water gushing 3 feet beneath his trainers. Then, with a deft duck and swing, he was inside the fissure in the hillside that they had found so long ago. Back then, it had seemed like a divine reward for their daring. He could no longer stand up in it, but